This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Scientific discoveries, especially in archaeology, paleoarchaeology, are sometimes filled with dramatic historic finds. You had Lewis and Mary Leakey at Olduvai Gorge, Donald Johansson and Lucy, those strange hobbits in Indonesia. But this next story, in my mind at least, is among the most remarkable and potentially mind-blowing of them all. Well, let me set the stage for you. Earlier this year, we reported on a remarkable discovery, a fossilized mandible studded with teeth found on a hillside in Ethiopia, some 2.8 million years old. It could be the earliest known member of the genus Homo, and it was an exciting find for sure. But yesterday, scientists announced a virtual galaxy of specimens to that single star, an enormous trove of hominin fossils, over 1,500 pieces from at least 15 individuals, and probably basically branching off about 2.5 million years ago. We're not exactly sure about that. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour, because they've named this species Homo naledi. And possibly more intriguing than the fossil itself is the chamber in which it was found. It was pitch black, hidden away deep in the Rising Star Cave beyond a long crack just 7 inches wide. And the place where the bones were found is so inaccessible, so deep in the cave, that expedition leader Lee Berger needed so-called underground astronauts to retrieve them. So he put out a Facebook post to find them. And I'm going to quote from that post. "Individuals with excellent archaeological / paleontological and excavation skills for a short-term project. The catch is this. The person must be skinny and preferably small. They must not be claustrophobic. They must fit. They should have some caving experience, and climbing experience could be a bonus. So you got to be in good shape. You got to be a caver. You got to be not claustrophobic. Hard to find folks who fit that description? Not." He was overwhelmed with responses, including one from my next guest who found herself on a plane to South Africa a few weeks later. Hannah Morris is an archaeologist at the University of Georgia in Athens. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about take us into this cave. Can you describe how you got into the chamber where the bones were found?
Yeah, sure. So when you enter the cave, you actually go through a series of long, narrow hallways and steps that lead you deeper underground. You come to a tall ladder, and you descend down the ladder, go through another hallway and drop, and then you're actually at the first constriction within the cave system, and that's called Superman's Crawl, which is a small tunnel. And we call it Superman's Crawl because some of the larger members of our team actually have to put one arm above their head and the other arm down to their side to fit their shoulders through this tunnel. So once you crawl through the tunnel, you're actually at the base of Dragon's Back, which is a tall, narrow underground ridge. So at this point, we actually put on climbing harnesses, and we clipped into some safety ropes, and we climbed 20 meters up the spine of this narrow underground ridge. So once you get to the top of Dragon's Back, you're also at the top of the chute. Now, this is where that famous 7-inch gap is. And so the chute is about 12 meters vertically that you have to descend. And I'm one of the taller and larger members of our group, so I only fit down the chute one way. So I have to kind of pretzel my arms and legs into these very specific nooks and crannies. And at one point, I actually have to turn my head sideways so my helmet will fit through the chute. And at the very bottom, there's a 4-meter drop that will take you to the floor of the actual fossil chamber. And there's a small slit at the bottom of the chute that I can actually lodge my chest into. And as I exhale a little and my feet are dangling below me, I can lower myself inch by inch until I can find that foothold in the wall of the cave or on the ladder and make that final drop into the Naledi chamber where these amazing fossils were located.
And so how many other people could do this?
There were five other primary excavators who were archaeologists and paleoanthropologists. And then there were also a few volunteers and cavers who were supporting us, and so they could also make it down into the chamber. So off the top of my head, maybe 15
wow.
people or so.
Wow. In a total dark, working through these little tiny slits in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
You are braver than I will ever be, Anna.
Well, thank you. You know, one of my favorite social scientists, Brené Brown, actually said that courage is being brave and afraid at the exact same time. So I will admit that I was also afraid sometimes.
Well, but you went ahead and overcame that fear. That is bravery. Thank you for relating that story to us, Anna. And good luck to you. And congratulations on that find.
Thank you so much, Ira. Thank you.
Anna Morrison, archaeologist at the University of Georgia in Athens, being called underground astronauts because they were the first to go or no one went before. What would bringing these bones? Why, first of all, were the bones so deep in a cave? This discovery raises so many different questions. Like, what kind of species could these bones belong to? Is it an advanced culture with a sense of a ritual, a spark that makes us Homo sapiens today? Where do they fit in the evolutionary tree? You've said many times on this program how various discoveries may rewrite the textbooks, and this would have to rank way up there. So we're going to talk about it for a while with Lee Berger, a research professor at Wits University in South Africa, an explorer in residence at National Geographic. Welcome back, Lee.
Thank you, Ira.
John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Ira.
John, can you describe what the species looks like? How humid is it?
Absolutely. And I'm going to apologize to everybody listening because we were, you know, cheering so much yesterday and doing so many interviews that my voice is a little bit shot. But I'm going to carry on as best as I can.
Please.
Yeah. So Homo naledi stood about 5 feet tall. It had a very skinny build if you were to look at it from a distance. Its bones and the legs and the arms, both very thin. So we think it was relatively small in mass for its stature. Its feet and lower legs were very human-like. Its foot bones are almost indistinguishable from those of modern humans. We think it had a very human-like stance, in other words. It would have walked in a very human-like way. Its hands, which are the most complete hands ever discovered pre-Neanderthals, very recent human fossils, are also strikingly human-like in many details. The wrist bones are arranged in a human-like way, more so than in any earlier hominin. The thumb is proportioned in the way that human thumbs are relative to our fingers. And the fingertips are very broad and well-made for grasping objects and manipulating them very in a human-like way. But the fingers are very curved. And the shoulders are also sort of canted upwards and placed laterally toward the sides of the trunk. And that's indicative of probably a very good ability to climb. It gave Homo naledi a really different look as you looked at its upper body compared to modern humans. Its hips were relatively broad and flared. And as we get to its head, the skull is configured very much like the skulls of early members of our genus, species like Homo erectus, with a brow ridge, with very large ridges on the sides and rear of its skull to support the musculature of the jaws and the neck. However, its teeth were quite a lot smaller than those early members of our genus, and more human-like in some ways, simplified in their occlusal anatomy. And its brain was quite a lot smaller than any of the early members of our genus, with a range from about 450 cc's to about 550 cc's. So looking at Homo naledi from foot up to the head, you start to see that there's this pattern of some very human-like features, some features that are most comparable to early members of our genus, and then some very primitive features that are only found in much earlier hominins.
And so how surprising is this? Does it fit anywhere?
It's very much a different pattern for the pattern of primitive and derived features than we have found in other species to date. In South Africa, we have a species called Australopithecus sediba, which is human-like, Homo-like, in some details of its hips and of its teeth and its face. Homo naledi is primitive in its hips. It's not human-like. And yet, sediba is very primitive and very different from humans in its feet. Homo naledi has almost human-like feet. So it's this different pattern of similarities and differences from humans that's very interesting to us.
Lee Berger, can you give us any idea how old these bones are?
No, we can't right now. The chamber that they're found in is pretty unique in the sense that they're the only thing there. That immediately eliminates what would be sort of a typical way we get a first thumb suck at a date, and that is looking at the animals that you would find with it when you have a chamber that's only filled with thousands of these remains of the species. Secondly, the situation is also very different than every other fossil site that we've worked with in southern Africa, in it's not been hardened into a rock-like matrix. So there's no overlying flowstones or underlying flowstones that we've been able to get a date on. The sediments that these fossils are embedded in are actually entirely derived from within the chamber itself. That itself indicates that the chamber's never been open to the surface. And even the entrance, wherever that entrance was at the time, if not the one that we come down, must have also been within the dark zone of a cave and very distant from any external entrance. Otherwise, we'd get wind-blown sediments and things. And we could possibly date those if they were young enough. So the fossils have also not been washed in. So we're left with this problem of how to date them. Of course, we couldn't apply some of the dating techniques you might get if they happen to be very, very young, like radiocarbon and electron spin resonance, because we aren't allowed to destroy hominid material until it's described under South African law. So we have to wait. But now we will try those other material. But the morphology itself gives us some idea where the species must originate. If our present dates are right, you described a claim that there's a member of the genus Homo that's 2.8 million years. That dentition is actually derived relative to Homo naledi's dentition in many ways. So are almost every other of the sort of early Homo. So we would suspect the species is over 2.5 million years in its origin.
All right. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk lots more about it. And Ian Tattersall is going to join us in the conversation. Our number 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about human origins this hour and about an incredible find of an incredible number of fossils in a cave in South Africa. Lee Berger is a research professor at Wits University in South Africa and an explorer in residence at National Geographic. John Hawks, paleoanthropologist, University of Wisconsin in Madison. I want to bring on another guest, a longtime observer of many years of fossil finds. Ian Tattersall is a paleoanthropologist and curator emeritus at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and author of The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack. Welcome back to Science Friday, Ian.
Thank you.
What's your view on this? Are you as blown away as everybody else is?
It's impossible not to be blown away by this find. This is one of the most staggering finds that have ever been made in the history of paleoanthropology. And there's only one comparable case I can think of, and that's the case of the Ciber de los Huesos at Atapuerca in Spain, where, again, a treasure trove of individuals and extinct hominid species were found at the bottom of a hole at the end of a cave. Nothing like this has been found previously. And I recall talking once to the guy that was excavating the site at Atapuerca, and he said, "I am the only paleoanthropologist who can decide at the beginning of my field season how many hominid fossils I want to collect, and when I've collected them, I can go home." And now he's not alone. These guys at Di Laleri are in the same situation, and it's formidable.
Lee, how do you react? Do we know how they got there? If there's this tiny little hole, and it's like going through convolutions as a spelunker to get down to that chamber.
It really is quite a remarkable situation. And obviously, initially, we were looking for the normal things. You know, a predator had actually killed them and brought them in there. But there are no marks on any of these bones to indicate that. They clearly came in whole. They were one species, and a predator really couldn't even fit in there that could take animals of this size. No scavenging marks. We could remove that this was some sort of mass death scenario simply because The material comes in over time. That is, we have material that we can see from the taphonomic situation and the layering and all that, that the material's coming in not all at once. So it's not a mass death situation. Also, the demographics don't really look like that either, where you have all these different aged individuals sort of kind of randomly selected out of the populations, including fetal age individuals, infants, very old individuals, mm-hmm. and everything in between. We could remove catastrophe. There's no collapse or anything. And again, they came in one at a time. We know they weren't washed in there because there's no external sediments. There's no lateral movement by water, anything like that. And eventually, we were left with a situation where, if you found this in a modern human situation, you'd say that's some sort of caching or some sort of deliberate body disposal. And we've been left with that hypothesis. Of course, you know, we are welcoming anyone to make additions to that hypothesis or give us further ideas. But this is obviously wasn't made lightly. It's been shopped around by hundreds of scientists as we've looked at the various lines of evidence, and that is where we stand now. That this non-human relative of ours was potentially deliberately disposing of its dead in this dark chamber. It must have been very difficult to get to because no other animal got there before, during, or after this incident.
Mm-hmm. Ian, do scientists like it that they can't really place the bones now? I mean, this is, you know, you're free to find an age, to find out, you know, there's no limitations what you could consider.
Well, I personally think that it's a kind of a cool thing that we don't yet know how old they are, and I'm sure that Lee and his colleagues are going to get a handle on this as soon as possible. But right now, we have to look at what they look like. We actually have to look at their anatomy in order to decide what they might be. And very often, people are influenced by the age of a fossil they're looking at in making that decision. And in this case, we're looking at them without things that are mm-hmm. likely to bias us.
John, looking at how all these other species approached human anatomy in some way or another, this one has more human hands. Maybe another has more human-like skull. Does it suggest that there's more than one way to be human?
You know, it's really interesting. You know, these different species were all influenced by their environments. They were adapting within an Africa which was very diverse in its habitats. And of course, we don't know the time that Homo naledi was living on that landscape. So we can't place it in an environment in that sense. We had a team of more than 50 people working in the lab on different parts of the anatomy. You know, a team working on the hand and a team working on the foot and so on. And they each were totally into their part of the anatomy. You know, they came in with data sets and extensive experience with what the hominin hand is like, and they got grooving on it. You know, everybody is like describing the fossils they have, comparing them to everything, and they feel like, wow, I sort of know what's going on here. And then they would talk to the people at the next table, and the people working on the hip would say, that's not what this is telling me at all. So as we began to build this picture, we realized that we're looking at a situation where we have different hominin forms which have similarities with humans, and they're different similarities. That must be the consequence of convergence in an evolutionary sense, but it means that it makes it very difficult for us to trace back which of those might be the, you know, the common ancestor of later Homo, and which of them might be off on their own little direction.
Let's go to the phones. John in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I had wondered how these were first found. Was there a spelunker that decided to go crawling down this very tight hole and see, you know, what he could find, or was it were you searching out anthropological specimens or something along that line?
Good question. Yeah.
Yeah, I can answer that. Of course, I'd actually hired a former student of mine to actually put together a caving team, an underground caving team. We've been looking for years in these systems, but without much success. And I had a map that had been created when we found the Malapa site back in 2008 of all these new cave sites. He enlisted two amateur cavers, Steve Tucker and Rick Hunter, and they are physiologically appropriate to get into very small spaces. I am not, nor is Pedro, the student that I actually hired. And they went into this rising star system, one of the best-known caves in southern Africa, went off the map after climbing up the route that Hannah so beautifully described, dropped down without knowing there was a bottom to it, that very narrow squeeze, and found the chamber. The camera was broken. They had to go back the next week to take photos. I saw those photos on October 1st, and that's when I organized and designed the expedition, and we created this wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, there are how many bones, how many fossils? 1,500?
We have
right now, we've including these papers, 1,550 individually numbered elements. They belong to about 15 individuals at the very minimum. We have left thousands of remains inside of that chamber. What I mean by individual remains, we don't know how many individuals will be left. That entire assemblage came from a first sweep of the floor where we got 400 elements and an excavation of about a yard by about half of a foot. So 1,100 or so of those elements came from an area that small. The floor is effectively comprised of remains of Homo naledi.
Wow, I'm trying to picture in my mind. There's something like Raiders of the Lost Ark down there. You know, the bones sort of piled up one on top of each other.
That's exactly what it's like. You can see this sort of thing in sort of Micronesian burial chambers, burial caves and things like that, where they just stack bodies over time in them. But that's what it's like. Of course, I've only ever seen this on high-definition video. I've never been there. But that is certainly the description of it, and that's certainly what it looks like when you use the cameras that we use so that we can be there to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
Well, yeah, it's the Tut's tomb of paleoanthropology, if you want. It's an absolute dream to have a sample like this of an extinct hominid with adults and children and males and females to give you some idea of what the population might have been like. On the other hand, it is isolated from all other kinds of information about that population, like environment and culture and so on.
Can you get DNA out of these bones?
We're certainly going to try. Southern Africa is not necessarily the ideal environment for that. DNA is best preserved in really cold places, really dry places. Our cave is pretty warm and pretty moist. But with an exceptional preservation, as we have on many of the bones, we think that there is some possibility, and we're working on that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sandy in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Sandy. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Ira. My question is, in pristine finds like this, where the researchers could very well be the first people in that cave, or at least by the remains, I wondered if swabs are taken of the rocks in the area, because the people who buried these remains, or that is their relatives, probably didn't work in the dark. They had torches. So I wondered if swabs were taken to pull any soot off the rocks.
Hmm. That's a great question. We will be, we've got rock samples from the interior of that cave. And of course, we're looking at ways right now to look for things like fire. We allude to that possibility in the papers. Of course, that is pure speculation. At this stage, the idea, because at this stage we have not found any burn material inside of that particular chamber. So we are looking at a variety of ways of using chemistry to establish that. We'll also be looking more deeply in soil. One disadvantage we've had is that there have been times where the water table has risen, and it appears that possibly it has risen into this cave. Now, the reason I say possibly is there's some conflicting evidence in the clay itself. There's some clay nodules that don't look like they've ever been wet. But we are doing every effort to test pretty much everything from organic material to the possibility of soot and stuff. And we're going to leave, without a pun, no stone unturned in this cave for this remarkable situation.
John, how close, you heard the description of all the bones, how close or how far in general was it from us today? And in advancing that question, Does this give us any idea of why our species, Homo sapiens, succeeded leaving Africa and spreading out all over the world, and this one did not?
Well, its relationship to us, if we put it on a family tree, looks like its ancestors would have diverged from our ancestors probably 2.5 to 2.8 million years ago. It's there at the very base of our genus, in other words. Now, again, we don't know whether it might have persisted for a long time after that common ancestor. You know, this species might have even existed alongside of humans as they evolved. But that's where it branches from us.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're looking at a time of extraordinary experimentation there between 2.5 to 2 million years ago. And we're certainly finding evidence of that in the diversity of the hominins.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Lee Berger, John Hawks, and Ian Tattersall. You know, I talk a lot about science and a lot of different sciences all the time. And I was struck the other day, I was thinking about the universe and cosmology and the idea of the multiverse, where there was all kinds of universes that possibly existed, and we just happened to be the one that survived. And I see all these different, you know, discoveries. Is there a multiverse in hominids? You know, Ian? You know, just something happened to be the perfect one that led to us?
Well, what this find is really emphasizing is that the evolution of the human family has not been the sort of linear trudge from primitiveness to perfection that we were all taught about, at least when I was in school many years ago now. It has been this, as John referred to, a process of vigorous evolutionary experimentation, throwing out new variations on the hominid theme to do battle in the ecological arena and to survive and give rise to descendants, or to fail and become extinct. And this is the pattern that's really emerging and emphasized by finds like this new one.
Mm-hmm. Wait, John and Lee, would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that it's Sadiva said that. Naledi says that in spades.
You're going to say something else.
I think it's totally cool that, you know, we now know that, you know, we're knowing more and more about the relationships of Neanderthals and later human ancestors based on DNA. We don't have that yet for Naledi, but it's certainly giving us a different picture of the way that ancient populations existed. We know that in recent human origins, they interacted with each other. They interbred with each other sometimes, even though they were very different.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that for early Homo. But we are starting to look at the fossil record in a very different way than we might have done 10 years ago. It's a really exciting time in our field.
Lee, you've made a name for yourself as someone who advances our knowledge of human evolution through aggressive exploration, finding these incredible new specimens. Do you believe there's still a lot hiding out there? And where would you put your money? You know, I'll give you the blank check question. Where would you put your money in terms of where to look next?
Where we're looking already. We've got exploration teams in the field right now. We're scouring this region, obviously, and we have made other discoveries. Once your eyes are open to these different types of fossilization situations like Malapa and Rising Star, you start looking in a different way, and we are making other discoveries. So you don't need to take that bet, and you don't need to write me a blank check. But I would say, though, is that we need to have exploration in other areas of Africa, other areas of the old world, because what this discovery also proves is that we haven't really explored at all. This cave is 1.5 kilometers. That's a mile away from Sterkfontein, the most excavated site on the continent of Africa. It's literally in the valley that the site of Sterkfontein, Swartkrans, and Kromdraai are in. The richest site ever discovered on the continent of Africa was right under our nose. What are we missing everywhere else?
All right. Ian, you're excited? We're all excited.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This just gives us an idea that we're just lifting the curtain on what was really out there.
And Lee, I'm sure you mentioned, I have to go now, but you mentioned something tantalizing about having already made another discovery. So
multiple discoveries. I'll leave you that it's more than one.
All right, I can't coax it out of you. We'll wait for it to be published, and we'll have you back on to talk about it. I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Lee Berger, research professor at Wits University in South Africa, explorer in residence at National Geographic. John Hawks, paleoanthropologist, University of Wisconsin in Madison. Ian Tattersall, paleoanthropologist and curator emeritus at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And if you want more Homo Homo Naledi. It's the October cover story in National Geographic magazine. There's going to be a NOVA documentary out next week, and you can find out more about it on our site at Science Friday. After the break, we're going to talk about how science and scientists can play a role in public policy decisions. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What is the role of scientists in public policy decisions? Albert Einstein, who wrote a letter to President Roosevelt warning him about Nazi Germany developing the atomic bomb, also wrote, "Those with the privilege to know have the duty to act." Fast forward to this year, where scientists have been quite involved with political decision-making. Sitting next to Secretary of State John Kerry as he hashed out a nuclear deal with Iran was Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, a nuclear physicist. The terms of the deal were spelled out during a face-to-face meeting by two scientists, Moniz and his Iranian counterpart, Ali Akbar Salehi. And just this week, a group of 29 scientists, including one of my next guests, signed a letter backing the proposal, calling it innovative and stringent. So what role can scientists play in determining global policy? Should they? How can science make inroads where other negotiations fall short? Let me introduce my guest. Rush Holt is the former congressional representative for New Jersey's 12th District and a former plasma physicist. He's now the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and executive publisher of the Science Journal Group, which puts out Science Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Ira. I always look forward to being with you.
Thank you. Vaughn Derikian is the Science and Technology Officer to the Secretary of State. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Ira. I look forward to this.
Rush, why did you feel it was important to send that letter backing the deal? How does a scientist view this plan differently compared to a politician?
Well, after the agreement was announced and the 100-and-some pages were available, some former Foreign Service officers and ambassadors wrote a letter saying that from their point of view, they thought this really made sense internationally. And then a group of flag officers, admirals and generals, wrote a letter saying from their point of view, militarily, it made sense. And so some of us with a background in the science and technology of nuclear proliferation and nuclear weapons and so forth looked at it and came to the conclusion that from our point of view, as with regard to verification and detection of diversion and the things that nonproliferation specialists are concerned about, this made sense. It hangs together. And as we said in the letter, there are a number of innovations, and it's really quite a strong, for this kind of thing, the strongest agreement. And so we thought we ought to put that down in writing for the president and release that to the public.
You know, I quoted Albert Einstein about those with the privilege to know have the duty to act. That was certainly along the lines of scientists who have the privilege to know about these things and acting on that privilege.
It is a privilege to be a scientist. It's an exciting path of discovery, but there are some obligations that come with it. Obligations for the practice of the science to make sure that we follow good ethical and rules of open communication and fairness in the application of our science and so forth. And then there are also obligations to, I think, to make sure that the science is used for the public good. And that means communicating with the public about the science, and in this case, the technology that's related to nuclear weapons.
Vaughn, as science and technology advisor to the Secretary of State, does science have a place in diplomacy, or does the Secretary of State just, you know, listen and sort of take it in that way?
You know, Ira, thank you for that question. I think that what we're seeing more and more in the world today is that the challenges that the world faces are now seeing more and more science, technology, health, engineering issues coming into them. I mean, you mentioned one of them. There are a number of others, from health issues that we saw in Africa with Ebola and the spread. We see it with issues around environment and energy and figuring out how to make both abundant amounts of energy but also in a clean way. And these are foreign policy challenges, but they are also inherently science, technology, engineering, and health challenges. And you see more of this. And it's the reason really why over the last 15 years there has been a real effort to increase the numbers of scientists and science coming into the Department of State. I am just on the job for the last 4 days, and I've had the privilege of being preceded by four outstanding scientists who've served in the same role that I'm in right now.
Mm-hmm. I know there's now that we're opening diplomatic relations with Cuba, Cuba has some of the most pristine marine ecology systems in the world. Is science going to be working, American scientists working down there to learn about that too?
I'll just mention just briefly that I had the opportunity when I was not in government very early on, even when the relationships were not where they are now, to be part of some groups that went down and talked about science, broadly speaking, not, as you mentioned, Ira, the marine issues are really ripe for a lot of cooperation, and there have been in the non-governmental realm. But even now going forward, there's a lot of the issues that will sort of underpin the relationship around things like atmospheric sciences and health and other things as well. We'll have, almost by definition, science and health and technology and environment as key elements.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones and take a phone call. I'm sorry. Go
ahead. And Ira, this is Rush. I do want to get in a little plug for the AAAS, where I'm now very pleased to work, and to say with some pride that Von Tarikian, until this week, was our international officer. And there he worked with the Cubans on scientific exchanges. AAAS has a long history of bringing science to international relations with respect to Iran, Burma, or Myanmar. And right now we're doing international seismology in a volcano in North Korea. So Vaughn, in his previous life and now as the science advisor to the Secretary of State, I think has done a lot and will do a lot to foster international scientific cooperation.
Let me go to the phones. Adrian in Phoenix, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. How's it going?
Hi, thanks. Go ahead.
Also, I just have a quick comment about scientists and politics in general, is that I notice these days is that a lot of policymakers don't necessarily understand what's going on in the world as far as science and what the latest technologies have to do or say about these things, but they also don't want to learn. And since scientists are essentially trying to learn everything all the time, I think that they have an obligation in politics to teach rather than make decisions. And I think that having a better educated populace to make decisions in a democracy will lead to better decisions in general with things like climate change and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Good question. What about the duty of scientists to teach when we're in a political climate and scientists is very much involved, Rush?
Well, that's what I meant when I used the word communication earlier, because I mean communication in the truest sense of really communicating ideas and teaching. And I think the caller was saying that the scientist should not presume to submit to claim to have better value judgments, to have a better sense of democratic values than ordinary citizens, non-scientist citizens, I mean. But we can teach the principles as well as the excitement and the beauty of the science, and we can help them understand the key points that go into it, into the political and social and value judgments.
Well, how do you answer someone who, you know, when you talk about global warming or climate change, how do you answer someone who's not afraid to say, you know, I can't make a judgment on this. I'm not a scientist.
Well, we have to get the American public away from that point of view, whether it's climate change or vaccination or questions of communication or teaching biology in high schools. There are things that ordinary folks can understand if the scientists are careful not to try to snow them with terminology and detailed methodology, but really to try to communicate the essence of science, or the practice of science, which is a way of refining our thinking to progressively better and better understanding of the world. It's a self-correcting system, and it's a process, what Lewis Thomas called the shrewdest maneuver. I love that phrase, shrewdest maneuver for understanding how the world works. It's something that anybody can do up to a point, and everyone should do, and scientists should help them do it, and not hide this this beautiful and powerful methodology behind methodological details and terms that are meant to obscure rather than elucidate.
But we're living in a time where Congress, the budget, especially for the National Science Foundation, is controlled by Congress and a conservative political agenda on the committees that fund NSF. Are scientists fearful of saying something might offend that committee that is funding their very research?
Well, the point is not to say that in a confrontational way, but to show where the evidence leads. You know, I often say to students, as you go forward professionally, and if you want to be on the winning side, follow the evidence, because ultimately the evidence trumps ideology. Certainly an awful lot that goes on Capitol Hill right now, and I'm, you know, only 6 months or 9 months now out of Capitol Hill, out of Congress, certainly an awful lot that goes on there is ideology, and often in an evidence-free way. And so it's a challenge for scientists to point out the power of following the evidence, of evaluating the evidence, teaching people that ordinary folks can evaluate evidence too. You don't have to just throw up your hands and say, well, I can't understand that. Let's leave that to the scientists.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
And Ira, this is Vaughn. I would just add to this, because I think Rush absolutely knows that world better than anybody as a scientist and as a congressman and somebody who's had to interface with that world. That one of the interesting things for me is always that we as scientists not only have to do a better job of communicating to the public, but also reaching out and engaging to those in universities and other places who maybe aren't going to go on and get their PhD in science. I had the privilege of being the offspring of a scientist who was a professor at Yale for 57 years. And when I was talking to my father, he would often say the hardest classes sometimes for him to teach were the introductory classes, because half the class might not be interested in it, or they might be taking it for different reasons. But in many ways, over time, he realized that he was a professor at Yale, that in many ways he could have access and teach them for just a little while about, as Rush mentioned, the beauty and the elegance of science, and that maybe that would captivate them in the world in which they were going into, even if it weren't going to be in a scientific discipline, and maybe stick with them. So that's it's another group that we have to cultivate.
But do you think that scientists should be proactive in speaking out when they hear something that just is off the wall, you know, about being said publicly about science?
Well, you know, this is Rush again. Of course they should. But if the other person or group is wedded to their ideology, then approaching them confrontationally will only drive them deeper into their ideology. And so the talented teachers, the creative teachers and scientists, if they're good, can help people understand that it's the evidence that counts.
Can you give me an example?
Not your preconception.
Yeah. Give me an example of where that would work.
Sure. I mean, right now, the probably most ideological debate is about climate change. Before any discussion starts, people have already drawn up sides.
Right.
And they try to say, well, we have more scientists on our side than you do, whichever side that is, as if this is a vote by scientists. No, it's about how scientists evaluate the evidence and how you, as a informed and concerned citizen who should care about, whether your kids are going to be able to have decent living standards, how you can evaluate that evidence rather than just assert again and again which side you're on.
Mm-hmm. So you leave it up to people to just look at the evidence themselves and make their own minds up.
Well, it doesn't work for scientists to try to substitute their understanding for the public understanding. First of all, it's not wise. The public, I had a rule of thumb often, which was never overestimate the knowledge of the public and never underestimate their wisdom. The scientists shouldn't substitute their understanding for the public, but they should help the public understand what the evidence says.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time.
Evidence-based thinking, is the goal here, I would argue, and it's hard to come by.
Yes, critical thinking. Rush Holt, thank you, as always, for taking time to be with us too. Now that you're free of those reins of government, we hope to have you back on a little more often.
Thanks. I'm really delighted to be at AAAS. It's a great organization with important work to do and important work underway.
And Vaughn Tariqian, thank you for taking time to be with us, and maybe we'll get some more insight into you as you've now become part of the government and learning as Rush did what it's like to be inside. So we'd like to hear from you a little bit later. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And you go to our Facebook page and like us there. We're tweeting all week at SciFry. To go to our website, we have a new reading list. We're just today putting it together for kids' books, science kids' books, if you'd like to take a look at that and possibly add your own. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.